Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Bridges, which is usually on at this time, is and will be on again in 2 weeks. Sharon Fong, who produces and hosts Bridges, is out of town. So I'm here a little earlier. I'll be here till 7 o'clock tonight. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, agents, and poets. And tonight we have a wonderful show. First I'll be talking with mystery author Pat Guyver. And around 6:15 I'll bring on my second guest, Danny Shapiro, author of Slow Motion, who will talk with me via the telephone from New York, where she's preparing for Thanksgiving. So stay tuned for an hour and a half of conversation with writers on their work and the writing process and readings. My first guest, Patricia Guyver, is the author of Delilah Doolittle and The Careless Coyote, her third mystery. She started in Fleet Street as a junior reporter, which was great training ground. We'll talk to her about that a bit later. She traveled to Canada, New York, San Francisco. She was a freelance travel writer, which I never knew. And she settled in Huntington Beach, got interested in animal welfare issues. Welcome. It's great to have you here again.
Thank you for having me.
I think you were here on my second show, and it was with your second book. And this is, I don't know how many shows it's been since then, but Careless Coyote is your third book. Will you just give our listeners a bit of the theme of the book and of your series?
Yes, the Delilah Doolittle Pet Detective series is just that. It's a mystery series about a middle-aged British lady, a pet detective, who lives in Surf City in Southern California. As she is a pet detective, she's always looking for lost dogs, cats. The book I'm writing right now, she's looking for a lost macaw. But while she is searching for these pets, she inevitably stumbles across a dead body. This puts her in conflict with the local police department, because while she insists that all she wants to do is find her lost pets, the police regard her as an interfering busybody. And so there is a conflict there.
Okay. We were talking on the way over about the fact that you have all these years as, president of the SPCA here in Orange County, and just all these years of working with animals, and how this book or the series of books couldn't be written by anyone else. I mean, who else would be a mystery writer? Who else would have all this experience working with animals? And even though you've never been a pet detective per se, will you talk a bit about using what you know in a book, and how that came about for you?
Yeah. It's interesting how life works out. I have been a working journalist all my life, and a few years ago got interested in fiction writing. But a number of years ago, when I first got to Huntington Beach
When was that?
That was in the mid-60s. And my son was really a toddler at that time, and I was really stuck at home. I had always lived in big cities. I'd never learned to drive. And here I was in Orange County, which certainly in those days didn't have many amenities at all and no public transportation. And I was looking around I was doing freelance writing, but I was looking around for something else that I could do. And I got interested in the local animal shelter. I saw an ad in the Penny Saver for volunteers. And I had always been an animal lover, but never really channeled that interest at all in any constructive way. So, although I had been doing freelance travel writing and celebrity interviews up until that time, my interest gradually turned to writing about animals. and also developing the SPCA, I learned about nonprofit organizations. There were a number of things I learned for the first time, and I used those as a resource material for my freelance writing. But from going from celebrity profiles and travel magazines, I gradually went to a cat and dog type magazines, environmental magazines, and using all that research material. At the same time, I knew I eventually wanted to write a novel, although at that time I didn't anticipate it was going to be a mystery series. So it just seemed that at a certain point in my life, everything came together. I'm a writer, and I had all this wonderful material, these marvelous characters that I'd met over the years as I'd been working in animal welfare. And when, a course I was taking, one of the exercises was to write the opening paragraphs of a mystery dealing with something that had happened the previous week. I immediately turned to an incident regarding a pet sitter, and that formed the basis of the first book, Delilah Doolittle and the Purloined Pooch.
Interesting. So when you were thinking about writing fiction, you weren't thinking, I'll write it from the point of view of someone who's been a travel writer, someone who's worked with animals in terms of SPCA type work. It was, as you said, a pet sitter, and that segued into a pet detective.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As I said, I took this mystery writing workshop, and that was that was almost accidental that I took the workshop, because I was writing a historical novel at the time, but I thought, well, I can always learn something constructive about putting a book together, whether it's a mystery or a historical or a romance. They all have the same basic format. So this I had received this telephone call regarding a pet sitter, and it really intrigued me. And so I just started writing that, and I realized as I was writing what a lot of interesting and sometimes amusing information I could convey, where I hadn't had the opportunity to do it with the nonfiction writing, the newspaper articles, which were usually advice to pet owners, and trade magazines dealing with animal welfare. In those, in that writing, I was preaching really to the converted, and here was an opportunity to forget that and to have some fun with animal stories. And as I say, the wonderful characters that I've met over the years. Most of my characters in my books are composites of many people that I've met. And that's just how it began. And it was really, at that point, I had no expectation of ever being published. I was just enjoying this new outlet for more or less the same material.
Had you ever thought you wanted to write fiction during all those years of being a reporter?
I always thought that one day I would write fiction. As I say, I was working on a historical at the time, and maybe I'll get back to that one of these days. Again, never really with any true expectation of being published. It was just something that I thought I'd like to explore and see how I could do.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever thought you might like to be a pet detective?
No.
Well, it's just that this character is so authentic. I mean, this is someone who is a pet detective. There's that suspension of disbelief. This is what this character is. So it's almost as if you've wanted to do that, or you've had experience doing that, or...
Well, in a way, I have, because working for the SPCA and earlier than that for Animal Assistance League, which I also helped found. There were many mysteries involved in that, particularly with lost dogs. How do they get where they get to if they do finally get found? How does a dog that was lost in Santa Barbara end up in San Diego and is found in San Diego? Those kinds of things. How does a blind poodle get from Garden Grove down to Huntington Beach? Those two incidents that come immediately to mind. And there's mystery there. And I guess if that was detecting, even though I didn't consider myself a pet detective. However, there are people who are pet detectives. It's not, I don't think there's a lot of money in it, and I don't know of very many, but I do know at least one.
Really? That's it. And has he or she read your books and commented?
I really don't know. I'd be interested to hear about it if he has. He's based in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Will you read a bit, a chapter from Delilah Doolittle and the Careless Coyote?
Okay, I'll read the first chapter. This particular story deals with a lost cat, and I guess what. Whether I intended to do this when I started out, what I ended up doing was drawing a comparison between the many abandoned cats that there are, and how do they get that way, and the cats at the cat shows, the kittens that cost $500 on up. And having attended a lot of cat shows and enjoyed them, and having several friends that take care of feral cats, the feral cat feeders, I guess that gave me the push for this particular book, although there are lost dogs in this as well, I hasten to add, for the dog lovers out there. So chapter one is called The Dispossessed, and we open with Delilah speaking. "No, Watson, stay away from there. There's a cat inside. You'll get your nose scratched," I warned my big red Doberman as I shoved aside pet carriers, catch poles, old towels and blankets, tools of the pet detective's trade, to make room in the back of my old Ford station wagon for the heavy cat trap. "Come and sit up front with me and keep me company," I told her, transferring the cardboard box of leashes, packets of jerky treats, tins of sardines and tuna, and a snake bite kit from the front seat to the back, wedging it against the trap to prevent it from shifting once we set off for the vet. My voice expressed the uneasiness I had been unable to shake ever since arriving before dawn at the cliffs above Dog Beach. I was anxious to get going before I had further close encounters with the dispossessed. The coyote, for one. If I hadn't been doing the Andersons a favor, I would never have seen him, lean and wary, slipping like a gray ghost through the early morning mist, following the imprint of his ancestors, and before them, the prehistoric mammoths that walked these Southern California hills 10,000 years ago. Eventually, he would have picked up the bike trail that paralleled the flood control channel from the inland canyons to the ocean, then crossed Pacific Coast Highway to reach the feral cat colony, where I was surprised to find myself that early autumn morning. "We hate to ask you, Delilah, but we've already set the trap," Joan Anderson had said, going on to explain that she and husband Bill had set the humane trap the previous evening, only later getting the phone call about a family emergency out of town. "All you have to do is check it early before daylight. If there's a cat, take it to talk to Willie. We'll be home in a couple of days." British transplants like myself, the Andersons were part of the loose network of animal lovers who monitored feral cat colonies nationwide. Worldwide, in fact, I thought, recalling the moggies of the mossy woods in my native England. In most cases, the ferals, usually the offspring of abandoned pets, were trapped, spayed or neutered, vaccinated, ear-notched, and released back to the colony. A sign erected by Surf City's Public Works Department stating that it was unlawful to abandon animals apparently had little effect on those who regarded pets as a disposable commodity. The Andersons had made this colony their life's work, dedicating their hearts and souls, not to mention a small fortune, to the cats no one else cared about. They knew them all by name, and household pets couldn't be better looked after, except that the ferals were vulnerable to other wild creatures, particularly the coyote, now heading for the area where Joan and Bill had left out food the previous evening. But coyotes were not the ferals' only enemy. Some people claimed that the cats were a health hazard and should be rounded up and euthanized. Bird lovers blamed them for declining songbird populations, though others, myself included, considered that the real cause of that calamity might more appropriately be laid at the doors of deforestation, pesticides, and development. Recently, traps had been stolen or destroyed, but Joan and Bill remained steadfast to their cause. Morning and evening, whatever the weather, they were there to tend their flock. It would take an extreme emergency, in this case a death in the family, for them to abandon their post. I couldn't refuse to help. If the cat took the bait, it would be helpless. Hidden in the bushes, the trap might go unnoticed for days. Belly low to the ground, the coyote was now stalking a group of cats, fighting over the remains of food left on paper plates along the cliff path. I picked up a stone and threw it in their general direction to alert the cats and distract the coyote. I didn't want any feline assassinations on my watch. As the stone hit the ground, the cat scattered and the coyote vanished into the bushes to reconsider his strategy. I located the metal cage-like trap, covered with a blanket, in the bushes just off the pathway. The gate was closed and I approached with caution. Maybe instead of a cat, an opossum or a skunk, lured by the strong-smelling tuna bait, had stepped on the metal plate, tripping the mechanism. Donning protective leather gloves, I warily lifted one end of the blanket. I gasped. Instead of the scraggly old tiger I might have expected, a large sable Burmese stared out at me with panicky, deep gold eyes. This must be somebody's pet. Surely no one would abandon such a beautiful animal. But then I recalled Joan telling me of other purebreds she'd found here, Siamese, Persians, even a rare Aussie cat. Perhaps he was a stray. I would check my lost and found ads when I got home. Whatever the case, I was sure Joan and Bill would be able to find a new home for this beauty. Glad that I'd had the foresight to wear my old jeans for this grubby job, I crouched down in the dirt and spoke softly to the cat. "It's okay," I said, hoping my low, even tone would calm him. "Dr. Willie's going to take good care of you." His only response was to hiss as I lifted the trap and started back up the cliff path. At that hour, I did not expect anyone else to be about, and was surprised to see a man walking somewhat aimlessly towards me. A homeless creature of a different sort, perhaps. Up early to ease limbs stiff from a night of sleeping on the hard ground. Dressed in grey sweats, his feet bare, he was of medium build and height. His face was partly shrouded by the hood of his sweatshirt, but there was something vaguely familiar about him. I couldn't be sure in this light and didn't wish to stare. I wondered if perhaps he was the one responsible for destroying the traps, and if so, seeing me carrying one, he might take it into his head to set about me, physically or verbally. He hugged something close to his chest. I couldn't make out what it was, but fearful that it might be a weapon, I stood aside to let him pass. I felt vulnerable, lumbered as I was with the trap, and wished Watson was with me. I'd had to leave her in the car. She would have scared the cats. But the man passed by, seemingly oblivious of my presence, and I continued on my way, the unwieldy trap bouncing wildly as its occupant grew more and more agitated. As I reached the car, a sudden gust of wind caught at my hair and brought with it the acrid smell of smoke drifting from the Cleveland National Forest, where a fire had been raging out of control for several days. It was October. Midday temperatures were pushing 100 degrees, and after a rainless summer, the brush was tinder dry. All it took was a spark, fanned by the Santa Ana winds, to create a fierce brush fire. "We're in for another scorcher," I told Watson as I drove the short distance along Pacific Coast Highway to the beachside cottage which served our veterinarian as both home and office. The vet was in his front yard, setting up a large wooden pelican which had apparently blown over. In its beak, the bird held a sign announcing Wellington Scott, DVM. A red and green surfboard leaned against the side of the house, still dripped seawater. Dr. Willie, as he was known to his friends, had obviously only just returned from the beach. Clad in a purple wetsuit, his long black hair escaping from a usually neat ponytail whipped around his face in the wind. He was in his mid-30s, a good 20 years my junior, but I could still recognize a hunk when I saw one. At 6 foot plus, he was at least 12 inches taller than I. "How's the surf?" I asked. "Waves are too choppy," he said. "Darn wind. Good weather for pet detectives, though," he added with a grin, lighting his handsome olive-complexioned face. He was right. I'd had more calls concerning lost dogs during the past 3 days than during the entire preceding month. When the Santa Ana's blow, gates fly open, fences come down, and away the dogs go. Whither they know not, and neither do they care, until they get hungry and tired. By the time their owners come home from work, their pets might be miles away. Most would be located at the animal shelter within a couple of days. But there were always exceptions, and I would be called in to hunt for the doggy MIAs. Such was the case when a tree had crashed onto the garage roof of the local residence, and two Alaskan Malamutes, confined there while their owners were at work, had escaped. Because the dogs were wearing license tags, the Lindstroms had let several days pass, anticipating a call from animal control. But no call came, and finally they contacted me. After an initial search of local shelters, I had dispatched one of my BOLO, B-O-L-O, Beyond the Lookout, flyers to shelters in neighboring counties on the chance that Matt and Matilda might have been picked up by someone who had then transported them further afield. I handed the carrier to Dr. Willie. "Joan called and told me you might come by," he said. "This one's lucky to have survived," I said, and told him about the coyote. I was so surprised to see him. He had to negotiate a couple of freeways, not to mention get through town and across PCH to reach Dog Beach. "It's the fires," he said. "As habitats are destroyed and the small game disappears, a hungry coyote will go anywhere he can to find food." "Well, he seems to have scoped out the feral cat colony pretty well," I said. Dr. Willie nodded. "You watch," he said as he walked me to my car. "He'll be picking off pets in backyards next. Ground squirrel, cat, or poodle, it's all the same to a coyote." I agreed. I didn't feel we could ascribe anything more sinister to the coyote than a desire to survive, just like the rest of us. "People should keep their pets indoors," I muttered to Watson as we made our way home. "What's the point in having a dog or cat if you're just going to chuck it out in the backyard?" Watson pressed closer to me on the wagon's bench seat, as if to assure me she knew where she was well off. As I turned off PCH and drove along the palm tree-lined half-block, past the 40s and 50s vintage summer cottages to my home, I tisked in annoyance. "Of all the bloody cheek," I said to Watson, "just look at that." A red Corvette stood in my driveway, leaving me nowhere to park.
Thank you, Pat. I love this book. I read this book in, I think, a day. And I love your character, and I love hearing you read it, too. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, Writers on Writing, here for Sharon Fong, who usually has bridges at this time. We're going to take a real short break. I'm going to play for you an important message. So keep a pen or pencil and paper nearby and take down the information. If you care about UCI, about picking it up from your home or room or office or studio or wherever you are. Here we go, and stay tuned. We'll be back with Pat Guyver in just a minute. This is the second part of our show tonight. I had an extended show. Some of you may have been listening. This is generally when I'm on. And now I have with me Dani Shapiro. She is the author of three acclaimed novels, Playing with Fire, Fugitive Blue, and Picturing the Wreck. She teaches in the creative writing program at Columbia University. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Vogue, and The New York Times Magazine. She also teaches at the New School, a course called The Literature of Autobiography, Memoirs, as well as Autobiographical Fiction. And I'm just very, very happy to have her here with me tonight. Are you there, Dani?
I am.
Slow Motion, which is what we're here to talk about, was a wonderful book. I just loved it. I love the writing, and I found it interesting that you revealed yourself so completely in this book without being sentimental, without being cloying, and it seems difficult to do in a memoir. Would you talk about that? Is it the author's self-awareness of what they're going through, or what is it that made that work?
I was very aware of some pitfalls that that writers writing memoirs can fall into while I was writing Slow Motion, and one was I was terrified of anything resembling either self-pity or blame. I needed to stay very, very clear about what my reasons were for writing the book, and it was first and foremost that this period of time that I wanted to write about was a story that I wanted to tell. I wanted to create a work of art out of a difficult period of time in my life. And I told myself the whole time I was writing the book that if I couldn't succeed in creating a work of art out of it, that I would put it in a drawer. And I think that that enabled me to write it all the way through and to stay. It enabled me to reveal myself, because I wasn't thinking about really what it was going to be like to put this book out there into the world.
Mm-hmm.
I did it alone in a room, really just thinking day after day, almost tricking myself into it, just saying, just write the book. You can always put it away. You can always change your mind about publishing.
How did the writing of it begin? Did it begin as you writing in your journal, dealing with a difficult time? Did it begin as an idea that you were going to do a memoir?
It began with the idea that I was going to do a memoir, and it really came after writing three novels and realizing that in some ways I was revisiting the same thematic material, whether I realized it or not, again and again. My first novel has a car crash at the center of it, or not even at the center, but late in the book there's kind of a sudden accident. And in my second book there's a violent incident that takes place in Central Park in New York, and also very sudden, very life-changing violent. And in my third novel, there is a plane crash. And it wasn't until I really looked back, and it wasn't even all that conscious, but I just started thinking, well, there's something here that's haunting me. And it's haunting me as a writer. I really wasn't interested in whether it was haunting me as a human being. I mean, the whole idea of memoir as catharsis,
mm-hmm.
I don't ascribe to.
Mm-hmm.
Journals are for catharsis. There are lots of places for catharsis, but good memoirs are generally written, I think, by people who have already dealt with the material they're writing about as people. They've dealt with it psychologically. They've dealt with it on some level emotionally, and now they're dealing with it as artists,
mm-hmm.
and that was really what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you... you wrote three novels before writing this, because slow motion seems to employ many fictional techniques. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. The character that, or the person, you, that we start with has changed by the end. And your situation is different. It's not, it may not be earth-shakingly different, but it's different. Was that something that you planned in writing this? That it would have that sort of arc and...
Yeah, I wouldn't say I planned it, but I was aware. I certainly was bringing myself as a novelist to the page. I was aware of shaping it, and particularly of the story that I wanted to tell and what to put into the book and what to leave out of the book. Perhaps from my life at that time. It didn't necessarily belong in the dramatic arc of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, yes, I was conscious of using my novelist's hat, or donning my novelist's hat
mm-hmm.
while I was working on it. But one thing that I did differently in writing it than I had done with my novels was I outlined it, which took me quite a while to get to. I was actually having a lot of trouble beginning it. And I was talking to a journalist friend of mine, and she said, well, have you outlined it? And I said, well, outline it? No, as a novelist, the idea of outlining something never would occur to me.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a novel is, for me, very much a process of discovery and of not knowing what happens next. And that's part of the excitement and the discovery of it, is seeing what happens next. And she said, well, yeah, but this is nonfiction. You know what happens.
Interesting.
And it was this revelation for me where I realized, oh, okay, so I have to outline this book, and the discovery of this book is not going to be in finding out what happens, since I know that already. It's going to be in discovering how I'm going to tell what happened, how I'm going to make the connections between, say, the present in the book and the past,
mm-hmm.
my childhood,
mm-hmm.
how I'm going to deal with memory. All of those kinds of questions.
Would you read a few pages from Slow Motion?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Great.
I'm going to read from the opening of the book. The night before I receive the phone call that divides my life into before and after, my face swells in an allergic reaction to a skin cream, then blisters and chaps. I am at a health spa in Southern California, a place where wealthy older women go to rest and rejuvenate, where young matrons snap their bodies back into shape after pregnancies, where movie stars stretch out on massage tables in private Japanese gardens, offering their smooth backs to the sun. I am none of the above, and for the past 3 days since arriving at the Golden Door, I have often paused amid cacti and rock gardens to wonder what exactly I'm doing here. I'm 23 years old, and my life has become unrecognizable to me. I have slid slowly into this state, the way one might wade into an icy lake, dipping a toe in at first, then wincing, pushing past all resistance, until the body is submerged, numb to the cold. When the phone interrupts my post-hike breakfast of a half-grapefruit sweetened with honey, I'm sitting cross-legged on my bed, listlessly flipping through the pages of the San Diego Herald, staring out the sliding glass doors at my private patio. I'm upset about my face, which is itching and beginning to blister. My eyes are slit. I've never been allergic to anything before, and I'm worried that this rash might spread down my neck and across my chest, causing me to swell inside, my body choking on itself. Hello? Danny, it's Aunt Roz, darling. Hi, Roz, I respond, confused. This aunt who lives in suburban New Jersey is not someone to whom I'm particularly close, and she would have no reason to know that I'm at this health spot, much less track me down here at the crack of dawn. So it doesn't occur to me to be frightened, though no alarm bells ring in my mind. I watch as my thighs begin to shake for no apparent reason. Danny, I'm calling because... She pauses, speaking very slowly as if to an imbecile. The first thing you should know is that everything's all right, she says. And then, Mother and Dad were in an accident. What kind of accident? In their car, they... Where were they? Where are they? Why are you calling me? Now, Danny, if you'll just slow down. She keeps repeating my name, and she says it the way I hate, the way my mother's family has always said it, with a sort of pseudo-classy soft A, as if we're from England, not New Jersey. There's an edge to her voice, as if she's somehow holding me accountable for being on the other side of the country at a moment like this. She thinks I'm a college dropout, a high-class drifter. They're both in intensive care, she says. Where? Overlook Hospital in Summit. They were driving home from your mother's office last night. Last night? It was late. There was nothing you could have done. I file this away somewhere under miscellaneous family insanity. I am my mother's only child. My father has a daughter from his first marriage, my older half-sister Susie, who lives in New York City. Has someone called Susie? No. How did you find me? Your mother gave me the name of the place you're staying. So she's conscious. Aunt Roz snorts into the phone. Danny, your mother has two badly broken legs, her tibia, her femur. Roz is a doctor's wife, the kind who thinks her marriage license includes a medical degree. Her husband, my Uncle High, is a surgeon and my favorite family member. I may be speaking to the wrong person. Where's High? I want to talk to High, I say. My voice has begun to shake along with my legs. High will tell me the truth. His hoarse, pipe-smoking voice will soothe me, tell me this isn't as bad as it sounds. I look wildly around my room at the sliding Japanese screens, the elegant, lacquered breakfast table upon which a fan has been set, detailing my day's activities. 9 a.m. aerobics, 10:30 stretch and tone, 12 o'clock massage. Uncle High is with the doctors. How's my father? He'll be fine, Roz says flatly. Not a scratch on him, and he wasn't even wearing a seatbelt. It's your mother you should be worried about. I don't stop to wonder why, if my father is fine, he isn't the one calling me in Southern California. My brain has gone numb, my instincts taking over. I will find out what has happened to my parents, one small, manageable blow at a time. I'll get the next flight home, I say, calculating how long it will take to get to the San Diego airport. Good idea, Dan, says Rob.
Thank you.
Sure.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett on KUCI 88.9 FM, and I'm talking with Dani Shapiro, who just read from her new book, Slow Motion. Was Slow Motion always the title?
For me, it was the only title that I ever settled on that I felt good about. I actually had a hard time convincing my publisher to go with it because of the word slow. They were afraid that the word slow was somehow going to be a deterrent. And it's a book that reads very fast.
Right.
But for me, so I came up with a bunch of really bad titles and then convinced them that slow was the right title.
So that's the way to do it.
Yeah. But for me, it had to do with a number of things. One was that the way that I found that memory worked when I was writing the book was very much in slow motion, when I found myself reliving things. That was how I found myself reliving them. And also the old kind of, that's how accidents happen, you know, that accidents happen in slow motion. And my book is centered around an accident. So, and then I found this wonderful Adrienne Rich poem called For an Album, and a fragment of it has the word slow motion in it, and I just thought, well, this is right.
Mm-hmm. Do you read memoirs?
I didn't read contemporary memoirs while I was writing Slow Motion. I was, however, teaching this course in the literature of autobiography, and so there were some memoirs that I put on my syllabus, but they were very specific. Right? A book that had a great deal of meaning for me while I was working and thinking about writing a memoir was Virginia Woolf's Moments of Being, which is a not very well-known book of hers, and it's a memoir. It's actually two memoirs written many years apart about her family. And in it, it's almost a primer. Anyone who wants to embark on a memoir should read it, because it really, she muses a lot in it about how to write a memoir and what's difficult for her about the process and where she gets frustrated. So that was one. But for the most part, I didn't. And then when I finished it, I found myself reading some memoirs, just because they were sort of in the air, and I was curious. But I always find that when I'm working on something, I mean, for example, my last novel, Picturing the Wreck, is told in the voice of an older Jewish man, a very particular kind of character, very kind of cantankerous and quite difficult. And while I was writing that book, I stayed away from Philip Roth. I stayed away from Saul Bellow.
Because it was too close?
Yeah, I was just afraid that I would be too influenced by their voices and that I wouldn't retain my own. And then, of course, the minute I finished, I was devouring them. I missed reading.
I'm curious, were you hesitant writing a memoir at all because of how your family might be exposed? Or how did you deal with all of that I would think someone who's writing a memoir would have to consider?
Yeah, well, part of it goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that I told myself the whole time I was writing it that I could change my mind. And that kind of prevented me from worrying too much about my family's reaction while I was writing it. And I also told myself that if I felt that I had gone too far about anyone in particular or any aspect of it, that I could always pull it back. And I did pull it back in places. The person I was most concerned about, really the only person that I was truly worried about once I finished the book, was my mother. And I gave the manuscript at one point to a friend of mine who knows my mother and said, could you just give this book a mother read? Just read it, and if there's anything in here that you think is too harsh, flag it for me. So I tried to be careful. I also became aware at a certain point that I was telling my story and I was only involving other people in my story to the extent that I had to in order to be able to tell the story that it happened to me, and that I was, ultimately I took some comfort in the fact that I think the person I'm hardest on in the book is myself. So that if there are places in the book where I am a little bit hard on certain members of my family, it didn't feel to me that I was doing it for the wrong reason. Again, to go back to the whole notion of self-pity and blame, you know, I didn't, the idea of writing, I mean, some people write memoirs out of this sense of revenge. Revenge, to me, is the single worst reason to write a memoir. I mean, it just, the memoir ends up smelling of it, where it just doesn't feel like it was written for artistic reasons or because it had to be written. And so I was very aware of that. I kept on examining my motives and my need to write it, and really what it just kept on coming back to was that as an artist I felt like I couldn't move on until I wrote this book.
Do you think the market for memoirs has peaked, or do you think it's still there?
Oh gosh, I mean, I think the market for memoirs has always been there, and the appetite for memoirs has always been there, the same way that the appetite for good novels has always been there. I think it's been interesting to watch over the last couple of years. To my mind, the entire memoir boom and subsequent memoir backlash have been generated by the media,
mm-hmm.
Which also, of course, generates more books. I mean, there are certainly writers out there writing memoirs because they think they're going to be commercially viable.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that I now know from personal experience that that is a terrible reason to write a memoir, because in the end, it's a very, very difficult thing to publish a memoir. You're very exposed. I'm infinitely more exposed with slow motion than I was with any of my novels. When I get up in front of an audience to read, there's no screen
mm-hmm.
between me and the audience. When I teach now, I walk into a classroom and my students know my deepest, darkest secrets
mm-hmm.
before I open my mouth. It's a very, very exposing and at times difficult process. So the reasons for doing it have to be sort of the right ones. But anyway, I got off the subject. Do I think that the appetite...
Yeah, I hear agents go from one extreme to another. I've had agents on the show, and some of them say, oh, memoirs are great, keep them coming, and others say, it's over.
Well, I don't think it'll ever be over any more than... I mean, a number of years ago, people were talking a lot about the death of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there will always be room for good memoirs. Yeah, perhaps there's been a glut, but I think that will even itself out in the same way as we've had all these different trends in the literary world. I mean, in the 80s, it was first novels and the Brat Pack and a certain kind of postmodern, ironic fiction. Well, that's kind of over, you know, and people were talking about the death of fiction. And now in the sort of mid to late 90s, we have this memoir, this sort of focus on memoir. I think that the focus will shift. I'm not sure what it'll shift to, but I think it'll shift away from memoirs. However, if you look at, you know, the classic memoirs that have been published in the last 15 years, like Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life,
mm-hmm.
or Frank Conroy's Stop Time, Those books are classics. I had a moment of realization about this when I was teaching Fred Exley's A Fan's Notes,
mm-hmm.
which was published in 1967. And a student of mine brought in a hardcover, and I'd never seen the hardcover of A Fan's Notes. And on the flap copy, it said, "The young man's memoir is all the rage, but this book is really different," because, mm-hmm. and then it went on, and I thought, 1967,
mm-hmm.
the young man's memoir is all the rage.
Interesting.
I think that there's always going to be a certain focus, a certain fear, and also a certain kind of prurient interest in memoirs, because people are almost embarrassed about their own voyeurism.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea that reading a memoir is really a voyeuristic thing. It's not an act of reading a work of literature. And in the case of a good memoir, it's completely not true. It's you learn as much about life and literature and the world in some way by reading a book that you know is happens to be true,
mm-hmm.
as a novel where you're suspending your disbelief and entering another world.
Hmm. Are you interested in doing more creative nonfiction?
What I'm interested in right now is really going back to writing some fiction, because mm-hmm. for the past couple of years, I wrote Slow Motion, and then immediately thereafter I embarked on this long, involved piece for The New Yorker that was a piece of creative nonfiction.
The Secret Wife.
The Secret Wife, exactly.
Yeah. It was in maybe 6 weeks ago, something like that?
It was in the beginning of September, so yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And I loved doing that. And I wouldn't be surprised if I do more down the road. But I've sort of lost my center as a novelist, which really, there's something that you miss working on nonfiction, which is as a novelist, the ability to just kind of take off and go and not know where you're going. It's a different kind of traveling on the page, and I miss that, and I want to get back to that for a while, certainly for my next book. If I do more creative nonfiction, I think it'll be essay length or something like another personal history kind of piece. But not. I'd be surprised if I do something book length for at least for a long time.
Mm-hmm. We're just about at the end of our time. I always dread this time. What's perhaps something else you could tell our listeners who may be interested in writing a memoir, something they should keep in mind? Reason for doing it, reasons not to do it, what to watch out for?
Well, one thing that I can say is that I know that I've been very grateful that it wasn't my first book. I'm a little wary of particularly young writers having their first effort or their first book be a memoir, because I think it can be very difficult to move on from there. I know that I have fiction to fall back on. I know that my imagination has not failed me in the past, and that there are other worlds that I haven't told my story, and it's the only... I think one of the biggest fears a writer has is, this is the only story I have to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you wait and you work on other kinds of work and allow your own story to simmer, then you realize when you write it that it isn't the only story that you have to tell, that it's a story that you have to tell. So that's one thing. And then another is a piece of advice that was given to me a long time when I was working on my first novel, which was a writer friend wrote me a letter and said, you have to write as if everyone you know has left the planet.
Mm.
Your parents, your boyfriend, your ex-lovers, your friends, everyone is, you have to write as if they just aren't here.
Mm.
And that may sound, in some respects, like a very selfish thing to do, but initially it's really the only way to get real honesty down on the page when you're writing nonfiction. Because otherwise, I constantly hear people say to me, but what will he think and what will she think? And that's the surest way to not get it written.
Mm-hmm.
It's too frightening.
Well, Dani Shapiro, I thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I love Slow Motion. I hope others read it. And thank you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. We're at the end of an hour and a half, and it's been wonderful. Patricia Guyver sitting here. Thank you again for being on the first part of the show. And thank all of you out there. I thank you for listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. If you'd like to reach me, you can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Bridges, as I said, will be back in 2 weeks. So next week, I'll be here again at 5:30. Till 7, I'll have Taylor Smith, author of Random Acts, with me, and Louise Rafkin, author of Other People's Dirt. It will be a great show, so please tune in. And now get back to work. Remember, it's all about sitting down and writing like there's no tomorrow.